I don't know what brought you all to this point. What motives have led you to come on a retreat, or whatever this is, a men's event at Padmaloka? I imagine it'd be quite a varied range of stories if each of you got a chance to say why you'd become interested in the Dhamma and why you'd ended up here. I'd imagine that for many of you, the story would be quite personal. It would be to do with a sense of personal frustration, of maybe inspiration. I imagine that for many of you that would be the case. But perhaps for some of you, the motive will be more to do with the state of the world and the possibility of the world being a very much better place. If I was talking in India, I would start with that assumption, that most people coming would be coming because they wanted to see a better world, a better society. Immediately, they'd want a fairer, a more just society. So yes, maybe you would find generally in the West, people would have a motivation that was much more to do with a sense of personal discomfort, personal frustration, wanting much more from life, as it were, for oneself. From India, people would come with a much stronger motivation to change society. Both of those elements are essential to the Buddha Dhamma. Buddhism is about personal transformation, and it's about changing the world. This is there right from the start of Buddhism. Both of these elements are there, implicit right from the start, explicit right from the start. And what I'm wanting to do in these 2 days is talk especially about the Dhamma revolution, the revolution that the Buddha started 2,500 years ago, and that is the attempt to transform the world, society, in accordance with the deepest principles of the Dhamma. Yes, the Buddha gained enlightenment 2,500 years ago under that tree in Bodh Gaya. That story is very familiar to everybody. And we know that he went through a sort of a series of stages and steps in fully digesting the experience that had happened to him. We're told that, for instance, he sat for a week under the Bodhi tree and just sort of reveled in the experience that he'd had. We're told that he sat for a week just gazing at the tree with a deep sense of gratitude for the tree sheltering him. In a way, you could say the tree representing everything that had brought him to that point. It's interesting, isn't it? The Buddha felt deep gratitude for even the simple act of being sheltered by the tree. And so it goes on. His first encounter with another human being took place, so the perhaps legendary accounts say, 4 weeks after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And it took place under another tree about 200 yards from the Bodhi tree. You can still see the place at Bodh Gaya where this happened. So he was sitting under the goatherd's banyan tree, just again absorbing the experience that he'd had. You can imagine that something had happened to him that was so momentous that although it was complete all in itself, its implications only sort of gradually came clear to him. So he's sitting under the tree, maybe partly just deeply absorbed in the experience of release, of freedom, and partly sort of seeing what that means, what that implies. And somebody happens upon him in a very, very remote area in the forest, in the jungle, and somebody wandering through the jungle happened to see him sitting there under a tree. And this was a Brahmin. Well, you know, Brahmins were and still are in India the topmost caste, and they still dominate Indian cultural life, even to some extent political life and social life. In much of village India, the Brahmins are really the kings of the roost, and they hold a very powerful sway over Indian life. They dominate this terrible oppressive system of caste. Well, that was beginning to be true at the time of the Buddha. It wasn't fully instituted in the part of India where the Buddha lived at that time, but it was growing in strength. So the Brahmin comes upon this strange figure sitting under a tree, and you have to think of the Buddha as rather a wild figure at this stage. You know, he'd been wandering in the forest for a long time. He'd been practicing extreme austerity. He wasn't in a neat suit or anything like that. He probably had more the appearance of a shaman than, you know, a tidy sort of monk or something like that. So you imagine him sitting under the tree, a rather wild figure with a definite uncanny tinge to him, an uncanny radiance to him. The Brahmin sees this man sitting under a tree. He sees the very strong presence that he has. He's drawn to him. And, well, he comes straight to the point. And he asks the Buddha, if you like, the $64,000 question. He wants to know, what is it that makes somebody a Brahmin? Now, at the time, that clearly was the most important question. What is it that makes for the ideal person in terms of Indian society? What is it that really constitutes the top of the hierarchy of the system? What is a Brahmin? And, you know, there's a standard answer that the Buddha should have given, which is, well, a Brahmin is somebody who has been born through seven generations to Brahmins. So a Brahmin, from the conventional point of view, is born. You are born a Brahmin. And then you become, you sort of establish your Brahminical status by going through a set of ritual purifications and initiations which constitute you a Brahmin, capable of carrying out the Vedic rituals which ensure the harvest, ensure you know, that sons will be born. Daughters sometimes happen, that's rather unfortunate, but, well, you need them for more sons later on this old system. So, you know, it's quite clear what a Brahmin is. And that would be the expected answer from a holy man. But the Buddha says, no. A Brahmin is somebody who acts morally. A Brahmin is somebody who acts on the basis of skillful motivation, helpful motivation. A Brahmin is somebody who adds to to human happiness. A Brahmin is somebody who stands by high ideals. That's what a Brahmin is. So in those simple words, in that simple confrontation, the Buddha launched a revolution in ancient India. He challenged absolutely head-on, completely uncompromisingly, the social system that was the basis for Indian life at that time and has been for 2,500 years since then. So the Buddha launched a Dhamma revolution. He, right from the start, made it clear that he had no truck with the immoral system that dominated society. Society must be based on deep spiritual and moral principles. That was his uncompromising message right from the start. So, the Buddha's immediate confrontation with society is a sort of keynote for Buddhism down the centuries. Real Buddhism. Real Buddhism tries to confront the situation on the basis of moral and spiritual principles. It tries to transform society, tries to transform the life of our collective life on the basis of moral and spiritual principles. That's there right from the start. And it's a dimension of the Dhamma that we must not forget, even in the affluent West. We mustn't forget that this is, even now, even around us, not an ideal society. It's not a society that delivers happiness. It's not a society that delivers justice. It's not a society that delivers real freedom. It's a society that is predicated upon injustice elsewhere in the world. It's a society that is destructive of our natural environment. All of that goes on today, just as the equivalent went on in the time of the Buddha. We should be making the same uncompromising declarations that the Buddha made in his own time. He never compromised for a moment, whether he was talking with kings, whether he was talking with Brahmins, whether he was talking with rich farmers, whether he was talking with poor people. His message was of an uncompromising ethical values which should create a society of mutual concern and consideration. So we'll be saying much more about what that means for us in Britain today. But I want to follow through the implications of the Buddha's message in modern India, for modern India. Because we have in modern India an exemplification of the power of the Dhamma to transform society that should be taken as a strong, inspiring and even challenging message for us here and now. So after the time of the Buddha, there was for a while, especially under the Emperor Ashoka and some of his successors, a real attempt to create a just society, a just and considerate society. I'm not going to go into that in any detail. We don't know so much about it, but we certainly know quite a lot about its aspiration, because Ashoka had chiselled on rocks all over India a number of edicts which set out his ideal of a perfect society on the basis of the Dhamma. So we know that he really tried to be a Dhamma Raja, a king who lived on the basis of ethical and spiritual principles. And as far as we know, something of that was achieved. And throughout the early and medieval period, Buddhist kings did come to dominance in areas of India, sometimes large areas of India, and they seem to have seen themselves as having a duty to try to rule on the basis of the Dhamma, of the moral and spiritual principles of the Dhamma. But there was in India a strong, interest, especially from the so-called higher castes, the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. There was a very, very strong interest to set that aside. And so you get in Indian history a very clear struggle, which was often a violent struggle. There's a lot of evidence to show that the forces of Brahminism deliberately suppressed monasteries. The story that's told in India today is that Buddhism died under Muslim attack. Certainly didn't help, but there's a lot of evidence that the real attack came from what we would now call Hinduism, and that monasteries were wiped out forcibly. So by the modern period, Buddhism had completely disappeared from India, except for, I think there are 20 villages in Orissa where people regard themselves as Buddhist, but they see the Buddha as simply an incarnation of Vishnu, one of the Hindu gods. So in, there's our friend from Kerala, I think, and everywhere you go in Kerala, you'll see Buddha figures and so forth. They're just regarded as Hindu gods. In Maharashtra, where Chandrasekhar comes from, Buddhism just forgotten completely. And interestingly enough, it was British archaeologists who rediscovered India's Buddhist past. And they discovered Bodh Gaya, they discovered Kushinagara, where the Buddha died, and they sort of restored the Buddha to India. So India, by the 20th century, was completely dominated by a caste system which had something like 30% of the population considered either untouchable or so far outside the system that they had only to live in the forest and keep themselves to themselves. Yes, 20% of the population were considered to be polluting. You know the story, the horrible, horrible story. It's still going on. I just read in The Economist, a good liberal free market paper, yesterday, an article on the Pardis, the criminal tribes, the so-called criminal tribes. They were given this status by the British, but who are considered to be genetically criminal, even today in India. Fortunately, but we're working with some of these tribes. Our own friends are working with some of these tribes in Maharashtra. And they're not accepted by the Hindu caste system. They're not allowed a place in the village. They're not allowed work. They're still often beaten up just for being, as it were. They'll be the first people to be arrested when there's anything happens, and so on. The caste system is as dominant as ever. It's just sort of shifted and changed its shape and form. So this is the reality of India today. Buddhism's gone. The Buddha's Dhamma revolution is just completely forgotten. Or rather, it was completely forgotten until about 50 years ago, when the beginnings of a revival took place under the great Dr. Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar. And it's about him that I want to talk. It's about the Dhamma revolution that he launched in India in 1956 that I want to talk, because what happened there, first of all, is very relevant to us, because a third of our order is in India, connected with that movement. People like Chandrashil, Sheshikant there, they're connected with that movement. And we need to understand our brothers and sisters in India and feel our kinship with them. We ourselves here in Britain strongly support them through the Karunar Trust and other work, the India Dhamma Trust. We strongly support that work there. So we have a very clear and important relationship with this Dhamma revolution that Dr. Ambedkar launched in India in 1956. So it's important that you know about it. It's also important because it shows us a very clear example of how the Dhamma can transform society. So that's what I'm going to describe to you today. I'm just going to describe the Dhamma revolution that Dr. Ambedkar launched. And first of all, I need to introduce you to Dr. Ambedkar. So he was born in 1891 in Maharashtra, near where Chandrashil lives, the same part of India as Chandrashil lives in. He was born into, I use the term, an untouchable family. It's a horrible word, awful word. You don't use it in India at all today, but it's useful to use it because it shows you the nature of the situation. It's now illegal in India to refer to somebody as untouchable. It's illegal to practice untouchability. That doesn't mean that a lot of people don't suffer from it, but it's illegal to even speak of that horrible term. But it literally meant that the touch of such a person pollutes you. It's a very odd idea. The best way you could think of it is the sort of feeling you get when you're connected with sewerage. I don't know if you've ever done any plumbing. You have to fix a drain. And afterwards, even though you've washed yourself, you still have the feeling that you're sort of dirty. I don't know. Maybe some of you are plumbers and you've got used to it. But I've certainly known this experience myself, that you sort of still have this horrible feeling, or maybe I'm still somehow got some of it on me somewhere. So I think that's the sort of nearest analogy we can get, that somebody's polluted by association. Of course, it's partly because of the jobs that they were forced to do, but then becomes completely detached from that. They can be, professors of philosophy or whatever, and they're still, you feel, ugh. You feel polluted by their contact, and you feel awkward around them, and so on. So that's the nature of the social response. People feel uneasy. They feel they want to keep at a distance. They feel very, very upset if such people get any sort of improvement. if they get into any sort of situation that's advantageous, if they got land or something like that, you feel this is wrong, the natural order of things is being distorted. At the time of Dr. Ambedkar's birth, this was really extreme. I won't labour the point by going into all the horrible stories that are told. Dr. Ambedkar's father benefited from the British, failure to experience caste as a reality. The British recruited from the untouchables, particularly from the community that Chandrashil would have come from, because they were very good warriors, and the British needed troops. And they made very loyal and very, very effective troops. So the British raised Mahar regiments, regiments from those castes, and they found them extremely effective. And Dr. Ambedkar's father had served in the Mahar regiment. Unfortunately, by the time Dr. Ambedkar was born, he suffered from the fact that the British had given in to high caste pressure to disband those untouchable regiments. But still, the British had honoured their relationship with the ex-soldiers, and they'd given Dr. Ambedkar's father a job as a sort of in charge of stores. I mean, quite a responsible job, which meant that Dr. Ambedkar himself had access to education. His father was a man who'd seen beyond the horizons from which he'd come, and he sent his children to school. That wasn't easy because they weren't given free access to the school. There's lots of stories told of Dr. Ambedkar's own experience. For instance, children always bring a tiffin, a box with their meal in it for lunch, and they put their tiffins behind the blackboard to take out at lunchtime. So Dr. Ambedkar, the first day, put his tiffin there. All the others were horrified by this. They threw away their own lunch because it had been polluted by association with his lunch. Now that's the sort of thing that he had to experience. But still, he persevered, and he was fortunately taught by a very progressive-minded Brahmin, and there are quite a number of such people, who saw that this was a young man of exceptional intelligence and vigour of energy. And he made a special point of encouraging him. Interestingly enough, when Dr. Ambedkar passed a particular exam, he gave him a prize. He gave him a book as a prize. And that book was A Life of the Buddha, which is quite interesting as an early point in his career. Later, he was got access to university in Bombay, again with the help of these liberal-minded teachers. He got access to a very good university in Bombay, matriculated from that university. And again, some of his teachers realised that this exceptional individual should be given special treatment. And they managed to get a scholarship for him from progressive-minded Maharajas, the Maharaja of Baroda and the Maharaja of Kolhapur. Maharaja of Baroda gave him the scholarship. The Maharaja of Kolhapur got the scholarship for him. And he was sent to, first of all, Columbia University, New York, in America. And there he had an extraordinary experience. For the first time, he was just another human being. He experienced himself as just another human being. Even Indians coming from India today will find that when they come to UK. Yes, we have racism here, but still you can get plenty of situations where you'll just be seen as another human being. People won't think, oh, what caste are you from? In India, the first thing one Indian wants to know of another is what caste they come from. So they'll ask a series of questions, all of which are targeted at revealing your caste. Sort of, what is your name? What is your good name? And you think, oh, they really want to know who I am. No, but the surname gives away your caste. And then they'll want to, if that doesn't do it, they'll want to know where you're born, where your village is, and they'll be all the time trying to determine where you come from. Well, in India, In America, Dr. Ambedkar experienced himself as just one human being with other human beings for the first time in his life, not really affected by that at all, that sort of discrimination at all. It seems as if he didn't experience any racial discrimination. At least he never spoke of it, as far as I know. So, yes, he got this wonderful experience. He also managed to study with some really remarkable teachers, especially John Dewey. Those of you who know your Western philosophy will know John Dewey, who was the first of the great American positivist philosophers. He got a doctorate in economics from Columbia University. He then went to study at LSE in London, London School of Economics, where he got further qualifications in economics. And he studied at Gray's Inn in London, where he became a barrister at law and got an LLD. So he went back to India in the 1920s, a very, very highly qualified man with a couple of doctorates to his name and some very, very eminent professors backing him. He'd undertaken to work in the administrative service of the Maharaja of Baroda as a sort of condition for his scholarship. So there he went to Baroda. He settled into the administration, or he went to settle into the administration. He was being groomed to take over as a senior post in the Maharaja's cabinet. You know that the Indian princes had a sort of quasi-autonomous status, so they ruled quite large areas in the case of the Maharaja of Baroda. They had their own government, and their own police force and military and so on. So Dr. Ambedkar was being groomed to take on a high post in the Maharaja's government. But immediately he experienced very, very acute casteism. He went into his office. Even the peons, the men who were employed simply to carry files around from desk to desk, wouldn't go near his desk. The story is that the peon who was in his office, somebody completely illiterate, wouldn't go near his desk, so he took the files that he had to give to him and threw them across the room onto his desk, because he didn't want to be near Dr. Ambedkar's polluting presence. You know, a man dressed in smart European clothes, with, you know, doctorates, with European experience and American experience, and this illiterate peasant wouldn't feel comfortable being near him. So this was his experience in the office. He wasn't allowed to use the collective water cooler. It's very hot in India, so that you need to go and drink water quite often. But if he went there and took water from the cooler, they'd be polluted. So he found that very, very painful indeed. He couldn't find anywhere to live because nobody would put him up. So he passed himself off as a Parsi, as a Zoroastrian. Lived in a Parsi hostel. Nobody else was there, so it was relatively sort of innocent. After a while, of course, it was discovered that who he really was. The owner of the hostel, the warden of the hostel, made inquiries, found out who he was. A crowd of people came to throw him up, threatening to beat him up. So he left with his trunk, sat in a park in the middle of Baroda under a tree, and you can see the spot where he sat. I've given a talk there. I've sat there. Our own Dhamma Mitras in that town have made sure that place is now looked after properly. He just sat there all by himself, just thinking, what have I done? I've got all this qualification. I've got this education. I've been given this chance, but it's useless to me. This is the way they treat me. What is it like for tens of millions, nowadays hundreds of millions, of my brothers and sisters? They're experiencing far, far worse than me, every day of their lives. And you can see a sort of crisis in his mind, that in sort of despair. He'd thought that education would be enough. He'd believed, you know, if you like, the trickle-down theory of modern liberal and free market theory, the economist's view, that if you educate people, if you create democracy, the American view, you walk into Iraq, you create a democracy and flowers will grow in the desert. Well, it's guns that grow, not flowers. It's not enough. It's just a sort of change in the structure, just educating people isn't enough. Dr. Ambedkar saw that so vividly in his own experience. So a sort of reformist belief, a naive belief that slowly things will get better, just as, you know, a more enlightened attitude spread through education. No, not a bit of it. And later in his life, he experienced as much oppression from PhDs as from illiterate peasants. So he entered a new phase of his life, which you could say is an activist, social, political, reform, activist approach. He became a Labour leader. He engaged in big union activism in Bombay, where the mill workers went on strike for better conditions. And he allied himself with Marxists, with communists, and forced a change in the pay and conditions of mill workers in Bombay, who mainly from the lower castes, and especially the Dalit castes, so-called untouchable castes. I'll say Dalit from now on, which is the sort of generally accepted term, even though I don't like that either, because it means oppressed. And I think that you shouldn't sort of identify yourself too much with that. You should think of yourself as a human being. That's another point. But I'll use that term because it's a generally recognised one. So, yes, he engaged in that sort of activism. He engaged in activism to get Dalits access to normal facilities. So, for instance, he led a satyagraha, a non-violent demonstration, to take water from a public reservoir in central Maharashtra. Western Maharashtra. Western Southern Maharashtra, on the way down to Goa. There's a big public tank which was built at public expense, but the Dalits were not allowed to take water from it. So he used that as a sort of, piece of theatre, you might say. And he brought together a huge number of activists to go and take water from the tank. And they managed to do that. The next day, the local Brahmins purified the tank. Just to illustrate the daftness of the system, how do you purify a tank that's been polluted by human beings taking water from it? You put into it the five products of the cow. Now, think about it. What are those five products? I'll leave it to your tender imagination to fill in the details. But they certainly don't just involve milk. But you put that in, it purifies the tank. A human being taking water there we are, that's the system. So he led that sort of campaign, and later there was a court case which he eventually won, forcing the tank to be opened. He tried to gain temple entry at Nashik. There's a temple there, Kala Ram Temple, which is a very, very important temple, he led a march to gain access there, because Dalits are not allowed, even today, there's still cases of Dalits not being allowed into the temples. In Orissa, quite recently, there was just last year, a big, big trouble because Dalits were being excluded from a temple. Finally, a compromise was worked out, which was that some bricks would be taken out of the wall of the temple so that the Dalits could gain darshan, they could see the image through the bricks. That's today, that last year. Dr. Ambedkar did not manage to get access to the Kala Ram Temple. The British were only interested in law and order in this instance, not in social justice, I'm ashamed to say. So he led many, many activities of this kind. He organised a political party, the Scheduled Caste Federation, which managed to get some seats in the Bombay Assembly as the British introduced local government and state democratic government. He gained access to that. So he was involved in this big fight to make the Dalits politically and socially aware, give them confidence in themselves, make them realise that they should fight for themselves. Gradually he came into conflict with Gandhi, because Gandhi believed himself to be the representative of the Dalits. He said, "We've oppressed you for thousands of years. It's our duty now to liberate you." Dr. Ambedkar said, "Yes, it's true. You have oppressed us for thousands of years. Why have we any reason to believe it will be any different now?" He said, "If you liberate us, we will still be in your power. We will still be in your control. We will liberate ourselves. We will lift ourselves up." And that's very much the spirit that he breathed into his own caste members, particularly those who are closest to him because they belong to the same community. But throughout the Dalit world of India, people began to gain more and more confidence in themselves, more and more courage. They were less and less inclined to give themselves up to be manipulated by usually Brahminical or high caste forces. Gandhi was himself a Vaishya, which means a trader, but he was allied strongly to Brahmin caste, like Nehru was a Brahmin. What is called the Brahmin-Banya combination. He fought for an independent voice for the Dalits, especially trying to get the British to take Dalits seriously, and saying that, you know, do not consider us merely part of the Hindu fold. We've been excluded from that fold. We're not even allowed into their temples. We want separate representation. We want a separate voice. He always eschewed violence, I should make absolutely clear. Although he engaged in these non-violent protests, as soon as there's any danger of violence, he stopped. It's one of his great gifts to India. You know, he's a man who commanded 100 million people. Who would have risen up as a man if he'd ordered it. But he turned away from that possibility. It's a very, very important point about him. He managed to persuade the British that his cause was just. And at a conference in London in the 1930s, famous Round Table Conference, the British finally agreed, Ramsay MacDonald finally agreed that there should be separate electorates and separate facilities for Dalits, as there were for Muslims, for Sikhs, for Christians, and other minorities. Gandhi strongly resisted this, and he went on one of his famous fasts. Now, I'm telling you this because when you talk to our friends in India, don't expect them to bow when you mention the word Gandhi. They see Gandhi as somebody who was, in a way, their enemy, because he patronised them. Yes, he was concerned about their situation. He patronised them. He wanted to continue the caste system, but in a softened form. Whereas Ambedkar was completely against it. So it's inhuman, unjust. It's not in accordance with the highest moral principles. So a confrontation took place. Gandhi went on a fast to death, saying that he would not eat until the communal award had been withdrawn. Dr. Ambedkar left in a very, very difficult situation indeed. If he remained intransigent, Gandhi would have died. That would have been on his hands, as it were. And, of course, people would have murdered thousands and thousands of Dalits throughout India. There would have been a bloodbath. So he was forced to compromise and to turn away from what would have really made the position of Dalits today very, very different if they'd had a separate political representation. It's a big question, but this is one quite important fact. So Dr. Ambedkar increasingly realised that there were two separate issues. There was the issue of the framework of law and of government, and there's the issue of society. You can have as good a framework of laws as you like, but the problem is the attitudes within society. He fought hard to create for India a basis of law and a basis for government that surmounted these terrible oppressions of caste. He gained extraordinary opportunities to do this. His talents were clear. He was recognised by the British as an outstanding figure, and he was adopted into the Viceroy's governing council, legislative council. So he was taken in, if you like, into the cabinet of British India and became the Labour Minister. And he created a framework of trades union law and labour law, which is still the basis of Indian law today, labour law today. After India became independent, Gandhi and Nehru recognised, first of all, his talent, and secondly, his political strength, and they brought him into the cabinet of independent India, even though he was not a congressman, even though he'd opposed independence. He didn't oppose independence per se, but he said before we have independence from the British, we need internal freedom. So if you just get rid of the British, we're just substituting one set of oppressors for another. Take away the British, you at least had a liberal background, as it were, and were the vehicle for liberal ideas coming into India. You're replacing them with Brahmins and Baniyas. And that's broadly what did happen. So he said, first of all, there needs to be a social change in India before we make this political change of getting rid of the colonial masters. Yes, they've got to go. They shouldn't be here. They've not done enough to really create justice in India. But still, they give us better opportunities than an India dominated by caste, high caste influence. Once independence came, he saw the opportunities. He was taken into the cabinet of Nehru and became the law minister. And he was put into the committee that drafted the constitution of India, the new India, the Republic of India. Quite quickly it became clear that he was the dominant force in it. He was made the chairman of the committee that drafted the constitution. Irony of ironies, an untouchable, forming the constitution of India. Untouchables who, under the old constitution of Hinduism, the laws of Manu, were given the lowest possible status. An untouchable formed the constitution of India. In the end, he was the one who actually wrote it. So he was in a very, very powerful position. He created for India a remarkable democratic constitution founded on the principles of liberty, equality, fraternity and justice, where the disabilities of caste were clearly brushed away and the measures put in place to compensate for them. Positive action, affirmative action was put in place and so on, reservations. Through which a whole community has lifted itself up. People like Chandrasheela will have been the beneficiaries, your parents will have been the beneficiaries of that, getting an education which they couldn't have got, however intelligent they were before. Dr. Ambedkar created that constitution. But he realised that all this work was not enough because the social system and the ideas that underlay that social system were not touched. And you see it today. Educated, high caste Hindus, well, and even lower caste Hindus, they still think in the same old caste way. However high their caste is, they still think in the same old way. They still think, well, these people, they're just not capable. It's somehow sort of endemic. is somehow built into them. I've encountered the same thing in Hungary, where people will say, well, the gypsies, you know, they're genetically inferior. It's those sort of ideas are very, very common in India. That so the old caste system transmutes and takes on new colouring, a sort of post-fascist kind of geneticism is quite common. So the attitudes are buried in the human mind, and that they're embodied in a social system. Dr. Ambedkar increasingly recognised this was the problem. He recognised this from very early on, but from 1937 he realised that the issue was absolutely fundamental. He gave a very famous talk at Yola to a big conference where he said, I was born a Hindu, that wasn't my choice. I that's just happened to be an accident for me. But it is my choice whether I die one, and I will not die a Hindu. That is in my power. He finally recognised that Hinduism was incapable of reformation, that the caste system was so deeply embedded in Hinduism itself that it was internalised so thoroughly that people could not change their perspective without changing their religion. Even if other people don't change their minds, you can change your minds about yourself. You can stop seeing yourself in the old caste way. See yourself as a human being. Get rid of the caste structure that you've internalized that makes you see the world in that way. So he began a quest from then on for a new perspective, a perspective that could replace the caste perspective embedded in the Hindu worldview. And this, I think, is something absolutely unique about Dr. Ambedkar. He saw that reformation, ultimately is reformation of the mind. He said, indeed, just before he died, in a conference where he gave a talk on the Buddha and Karl Marx, he said that the greatest thing that the Buddha has taught the world is that the world cannot be reformed except by a reform of the mind. So reformation has to begin internally. A reformation has to be a change in attitude. It's not just a question of changing constitution. It's not just a question of laws. Those are important because they facilitate that process. The changes in the laws of India have meant that many more Dalits are educated and have got good jobs and so forth. But the fundamental structure of Indian thought hasn't changed. Not changed enough. There are people who've changed. There are high caste people with very, very liberal ideas and so forth. But still, the fundamental nature of Indian society is dominated by this old caste system. It's colonised democracy. It's colonised the wonderful constitution, the wonderful system of law. So Dr. Ambedkar said, you've got to change the religion, your religion, so that you see yourself differently. You've got to take on a religion where you see yourself as a human being responsible for yourself, bound by universal ethical principles, not by group principles, not by social ideas, not by hierarchical ideas imbibed from without. You must find for yourself a moral principle to stand upon. It seems fairly clear from quite early on he'd been very strongly attracted to Buddhism, and he believed that in Buddhism that set of ideas were to be found, that vision was to be found, because Buddhism is, for a start, not a religion based on myth. It's not based on a myth about the origins of things, like, you know, the Hindu caste system teaches that the different castes come from different parts of the body of the sort of cosmic man. Brahmins come from the tongue, the head, yeah. The Kshatriyas from the arms, the Vaishyas from the thighs, and the Shudras from the feet, because they do the walking and they're to be walked upon, as it were. So there's a sort of cosmic myth. I've just been reading about Shiism under Padmavajra's tutelage. He's my sheikh. And in Shiism, you know, a lot of the trouble we've got in the Middle East at the moment is to do with the belief that of the martyrdom of a Caliph Ali. So a lot of the political action that takes place is rooted in a cosmic myth about the way history it relates to gigantic forces. You know, like I read somewhere recently that part of the reason for the Second Iraq War, was that the Christian right in America, extreme Christian right in America, believed that Armageddon would happen in Israel, and that would be the prelude to the second coming of Christ. So let's go over there and create Armageddon. Yeah, I'm afraid it's... Unfortunately, they're not the dominant voice, but they certainly did have a tremendous amount of power. So it's these mythic views of history that pervert human relationships. You stop seeing things in terms of one human being in relation to another. You see things in terms of a relationship to cosmic forces, God, and so on. Dr. Ambedkar said that a religion that is based on the relationship between man and God has no ethics. His ethics is to do with the relationship between one human being and another human being. It's not relationship. It's not to do with whether you're pleasing God or not. It's to do with whether you are regarding the humanity of another human being. So he found in Buddhism a reasonable religion that did not contradict science. It doesn't matter to us when the universe was created. It doesn't matter to us that evolution is increasingly an obvious, a theory that fits the facts. It doesn't matter to us. It doesn't contradict anything that's fundamental to our beliefs. What matters to us is that enlightenment is possible. What matters to us is that reality is an assemblage of conditioned processes. That's what matters to us. What matters to us is that there is within reality a process that leads to liberation, which is embedded in the nature of things, just as much as gravity is. So Dr. Ambedkar found in Buddhism a religion that was reasonable, you could say, that did not contradict modern standards of scholarship, of scientific inquiry. He found in Buddhism a religion that was not incompatible with social values, with liberty, equality, and fraternity. He used these as his idea of a just society. He said that I derive these principles, liberty, equality, and fraternity, not from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha. There's a lot more that could be said about that, but time is running out. These principles derive from the Dhamma. In his reading of them, which is embodied in the Indian constitution in this sense. So lastly he said that Buddhism does not ennoble poverty. He says voluntary poverty is fine. If somebody wants to be poor, if they want to take on a vow of poverty, that's fine, that's up to them. But we should not have religions which say that poverty is justified. I don't know whether you remember this from your childhoods, if any of you go back this far, that the hymn, the rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, he made them high and lowly and ordered their estate. I used to sing this as a little boy. I always thought it was a bit odd. I don't think I like God. Fortunately, I'm not at the gate. I wasn't exactly in the castle, but I was sort of halfway up the driveway. the great British middle class. It's sort of many religions have this sort of idea that, you know, social hierarchies are God-given. They're made by the sort of cosmic law. Buddhism doesn't believe that. It doesn't even teach that it's determined by karma. Karma may have an influence, but you cannot say that it's a determining influence. So you cannot say of somebody, he's poor and oppressed, that's just what he deserves. It's not for me to do anything about it. He just needs to do his caste duty. Next lifetime, he may manage to get up a little bit higher. or whatever. If he's very, very good, he may go to heaven. So Buddhism has nothing of that kind. It doesn't justify poverty. It doesn't justify inhumanity at all. So Dr. Ambedkar finally came to the conclusion that the most radical act he could perform was to provide for India, and especially for his own people, something that would fundamentally change their attitudes to themselves, their attitudes to society. So he converted to Buddhism in 1956. He believed that through that conversion, first of all, people would gain dignity. Those who came from those poor, oppressed communities would stand up. They'd say, I'm a human being. You know, whatever you may think of me, I regard myself as an equal human being with you. Secondly, they would gain a sense of responsibility. It's my life. Whether that life is a good life or a bad life, it's in my hands. It's up to me whether I live that life well or if I live that life badly. It's not up to God. It's not up to some external force. It's not up to priests. It's up to me whether I make something of this life, whether I find fulfillment in this life or not. And he showed his people that path. And, millions of them over the next years converted. And, our two friends here come from the results of that movement. And it gave tremendous confidence to people. You can't believe what confidence it gave. But it is represented in the statistics. You can see those who came, like Chandrashil's grandfather or father, would have converted in 56?
No, brother was not
there. But sometime at around that time, they had converted. And they'd have immediately thrown away the gods. They'd have gone back home from conversion. They'd have taken down all the pictures, taken the murti, the images off their shrines. They'd have thrown them in the dust heap, thrown them in the river. They would have just got rid of the idea of themselves as untouchable, the idea of themselves as Dalit. They'd have began to fight for the education of their children. They would have starved themselves in some cases to give their children a better life. They're amazing. Some of these people, I know some of these people, but Padmavajra and Chandrashil will know them, people who were there in 1956, often illiterate or very, very badly educated, but lions, such extraordinary human beings, very, very simple, but such strength, such courage, such dignity, and so upright. Strong moral principles, and so concerned about their brothers and sisters. Really extraordinary people. And it made a huge change in the lives of millions of people. See in the government statistics, those who converted, and their sons and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, have improved their socio-economic situation, their educational status, out of all proportion to comparable castes who did not convert. We've got a scientific control group of communities that castes that didn't convert that were exactly parallel, and those that did convert, you see them shooting ahead. So double the number of high school leavers, double the number of proportion of people in good jobs, and so on. So it just gave people the confidence, the courage to stand up for themselves, to stand up for their society, a strong sense of responsibility, a strong sense of moral principle, they got from Buddhism. And it made an immediate difference. That was the first target of Dr. Ambedkar's conversion. There's another target. He wanted that conversion for the whole of India. And his plan was to go throughout India over the weeks following the conversion in October the 14th, 1956, to go through India, converting people caste by caste. And it was all planned, broadly planned. He died 7 weeks after conversion, 6 weeks after conversion. So the movement just stalled. If he'd lived, it's undoubted that the movement would have spread throughout India, the Dalit communities, and it would have begun to spread to other more liberal-minded, reform-minded, high-caste Hindus. Because he saw it as something for the whole of India. In a way, unless everybody becomes a Buddhist, nobody becomes a Buddhist. Unless everybody gets rid of caste, nobody gets rid of caste. But he saw there was a possibility of more and more people coming into Buddhism. That would then give India a basis of morality. This is one of his most important insights. And something we'll come back to tomorrow. But he saw that society is upheld not by law alone, not by constitutional structures alone. These are important, but they can only deal with, in the case of the law, with a recalcitrant few. In the case of the constitutional system, they can only order the forces of society so that there's a peaceful means of negotiating power. But the fundamental way in which society works is down to the culture. It's down to the attitudes that people have in their mind and the social attitudes that we share. I think in Britain today, we still function on the basis of a mixture of very late Christian ideas, of moral ideas, and of the whole Greco-Roman sort of moral citizenship tradition. We exist on the tail end of that. I might even say the fag end of that. I think it's running out very rapidly. And what's interesting is we're challenged by, in our midst, a completely different political ideology coming from Islam, which is very definitely an ideology, a political ideology. So, yes, we're trading on that. But it's not enough. It's not enough to keep society moral. You see it in India. India has as good a constitution as anywhere, better than many. For such a vast a country, if it's a billion and more, 1.2 billion people, to have orderly transition of power over more than 50 years is remarkable. Well, 60 years now. Utterly remarkable. That constitution has really stood India in good stead. It has a wonderful framework of law. It's got a fully liberal system of law, which is as good as anywhere, just as, up to European standards, you might say. But Indian society is not free. It's not liberal. You can't do what you want. You can't live where you want. Well, to take a topical case, homosexuality. It's only just been liberalised in India. But it's very, very difficult to openly practice homosexuality in India. It's very, very deeply taboo, to just give one, an issue that for us is fairly normal now. Not before 1960, perhaps, but it's still very, very much taboo. And many, many kinds of freedom are not accessible to people in India, particularly lower caste people. Because whatever the law is, whatever the constitution is, the social structure is not free. The moral system is not one that is truly just. So the whole political system, even the legal system, is corrupted by caste thinking. Voting takes place on a caste basis. The legal system is corrupted by caste. So if you want justice, you need to make sure you find people of your caste who will help you. It's not an impartial system. Not that ours is completely impartial, but it's much less dominated by ethnic interest, if you like. So the worth of society rests in its culture. The political system, the legal system, aid that, but they are based upon something much deeper. This was Dr. Ambedkar's great vision, great insight, that before you can have a real revolution, a revolution at the social and cultural level, at the social and political level, you need to have a revolution at the cultural level. There needs to be a change in people's attitudes and ideas. And particularly their moral ideas. They need to have a morality that's based on human principles, not on God-given principles or, scientific materialism or anything like that. It needs to be based on honest human relationships, an idea of the love that we owe each other. And he had a very lofty vision of democracy. He saw democracy not as a political system or a system for voting, but as an ideal. He said that democracy is not a system of voting. It is an attitude of mind. It's an attitude of respect and reverence of one citizen for another. So he believed that for India really to get away from its unjust system, which persists today, and very, very strongly persists today in many, many different ways, there needs to be a change in the fundamental attitudes. And he thought the best means for that change was to be found in the Buddha Dhamma. Because he said it's not enough just to have a humanistic ethics, just an idea that we should be nice to each other. That needs to be some deeper sanction, some deeper support. He said morality should be universal, not just local and group based, should be based on universal principles, but it should be rooted in what he called something sacred, something that transcends our mere humanity. Well, in a way, we live in a society that very ably serves individual interest, but individual interest is not enough to govern a society. This is the old, you know, the misreading of Adam Smith, isn't it? But individual interest is not enough. It doesn't create happiness. It doesn't create justice. It does to some extent, but only does it while things are good, when we're wealthy. What's going to happen? You know, there's a big debate now, isn't it? What's going to happen when more and more public sector workers are out of work? We're probably going to see a lot of social upheaval. And it could, of course, get extreme if things got really bad economically. There isn't a basis in the modern individualistic possessivism, the consumerism is a dominant religion of our times. Tesco's is the main temple of our new religion, consumerism. It's not enough to really sustain society, especially when things get difficult. There needs to be a deeper set of moral principles which are rooted in something that's more than merely personal human interest. And he found that in the Dhamma. He found that in the Dhamma, which because in the Dhamma, ethics is rooted in the nature of things. It's rooted in Kamma, it's rooted in Dhamma. That's another big topic, but you probably get the clues to what I'm talking about. Morality for Buddhists is rooted in the very nature of things, so that we, when we live out morality, we serve something more than our own interest. It's in our interest, but it's something more than our interest. So he believed that his conversion to Buddhism wasn't merely a way out for his own oppressed brothers and sisters. It was a basis for a just society, a free and just society. So his final gift to his people, his final gift to India was the Buddha Dhamma. But I believe that his particular approach to the Buddha Dhamma was a gift to the world, is a gift to us. What he had to say about the nature of the Dhamma in relation to social freedom and justice and a good society applies to us now. If we want a good society in Britain or Venezuela or wherever, what we need is to bring the power of the Dhamma into play in the social and political arena. So it's that I'll be talking about tomorrow. What Dr. Ambedkar said is plainly effective for his own people. It's lifted them up and lifting up more and more people in India. The revolution goes on. It got stalled, but it's going on. Even at the political level, there's a massive a new revival of Ambedkar's vision. There's an Ambedkarite party in power in UP, which if it was a country, Uttar Pradesh, which is a state in India, if it was a country, it would be the sixth biggest in the world. 180 million people, is ruled by a woman who says she'll become a Buddhist when she gets to be Prime Minister of India, and she may do. It's doubtful, but she may do. I'm not sure whether I want her to or not, that's another question. I'd like her to be perhaps more based in Buddhism than she is. Yes, it's still a rolling force in India. But I believe that force needs to roll much more vigorously in the West. Our own movement in the West is strongly connected with that movement in India. Sangharakshita, who founded the order here, was connected with Dr. Ambedkar. He had three very important meetings with Dr. Ambedkar in the 50s, and was then, after Dr. Ambedkar's death, very strongly connected with the movement of conversion. From 1979 onwards, our movement has been spreading in India. And we have now, at least a third of our order are Indians from that background. And we have some of our leading order members from India, like Chandrasheela, who's a public preceptor from India. So that Ambedkarite movement has connected very strongly with our own movement in the West. And I believe that the two have a very, very important contribution to make to each other, and that we need to work both inspired by Dr. Ambedkar's vision here in the West, and we need to help and support with the resources that we've got in the West that movement in India. So I'll be exploring further how that all affects us right now here in the West, in the middle of an appalling election campaign. What it all really, in a way, as I say, we've actually got a modicum of political power right now. How are we going to use that on May the 6th? More to the point, how are we going to use it before May the 6th? Because I think it counts more before than at the point. How are we going to use it? And so I'm hoping that tomorrow I'll at least give you some sort of idea about how to vote. I'm not going to tell you who to vote, because I've not no idea. It's a choice where you don't have a choice. It's not an obvious one. But we need to use the power that we've got, and then we need to use it far more vigorously to affect society as a whole. So there you are. You've heard about the Dhamma Revolution East. Tomorrow, the Dhamma Revolution West.